So sure, 9 out of 10 startups fail. I get that. And a lot of people say that, don't worry, 9 out of 10 fail. I was like, I didn't plan on being the 9 out of 10. Mm-hmm. You know, my investors were betting on me being the 1 out of 10, and calling them all up and feeling, I just felt so much. I felt like I disappointed people. I felt ashamed that I'd failed. I felt like I disappointed people. I felt like I'd let them down. And that was the hardest part for me, because I have always been really sensitive to what other people think. I've always cared far too much what other people think. So you can imagine being a people pleaser, being a, you know, success addict, someone who's always been done well, and then not just failing, but I'm talking like skidding on my face failing, you know, and then having to call everyone up and be like, by the way, I just failed. And because I failed, you're losing your 25 grand or you're losing your 250 grand or whatever it is that you put in. Those calls were just so, you know, devastating. And what was incredible about it is that some of them, the guy who, you know, put in $250,000, actually a guy who put in 350 grand, he put in more than anyone else. He was like, just get up, dust yourself off, move on to the next thing. You know, you gave it your all. Good job. You made an impact in the world. And, you know, I believe in you for your next venture, you know, which was incredible. And then you go to the people that put in, a couple of people that put in 10 grand were just all over me like white on rice, and making me feel 10 times, let's say, what their actions made me feel 10 times worse than I had already felt.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. In the next few weeks, we're looking to redesign the Unmistakable Creative website. We know there are a lot of you in our community who are designers and developers. If you're a WordPress developer or designer, we'd love to hear from you. Visit unmistakablecreative.com/redesign to see the specs and tell us a bit more about your work and your portfolio. And as always, today's episode of the Unmistakable Creative is brought to you by our friends at HostGator. If you have an existing website and you want to move that website to HostGator, they make it simple and it's free to move. If you want to start a new website, they're providing 24/7 live support via phone, chat, and email, an easy-to-use website builder if you're not too tech-savvy, and one-click WordPress installs if you want to get your hands dirty. And because you're an Unmistakable Creative listener, they're offering 30% off all of their hosting packages to listeners of the Unmistakable Creative. So visit hostgator.com/creative and use the promo code creative at checkout for 30% off. Taylor, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
It is my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it is very cool to have you here. So I was introduced to you by way of a former guest of ours and mutual friend, Rima Zaman. She had nothing but amazing things to say about you. And then when I found out what you did and the fact that you were a surfer, I was like, wow, we're like long lost brothers. We definitely need to talk.
Yeah, and we need to surf more realistically.
Yeah, exactly. More than talk, we need to get out and surf together. But I want to start by asking you, what did your parents do for a living? And how did that end up impacting the choices that you've ended up making with your life and your career?
That's so funny that you asked that, because I was just at a founders retreat with my two co-founders yesterday, and we were talking about our relationship with money and where that comes from. And it's so interesting. Like one of my co-founders grew up, let's say, lower middle class, maybe even slightly below, but probably lower middle class. The other one grew up very high middle class, like slightly above middle class, so quite wealthy. Mm-hmm. And then I grew up starting at when I was four, poor. And then by the time I was like 16, upper middle class, you know, so like I watched my dad like hustle. Oopsie. I watched my, my dad hustle from, you know, us renting like a half a duplex in the shady part of town to building his own house and getting a cabin on the water on a lake and improving on that cabin. So watching it all happen. And so my parents, in short, my dad was an entrepreneur. He was a real estate agent when I was two. I then became a real estate agent down the road. He started a company called Conroy Exteriors that does like gutters and roofing and siding. And so in essence, a construction company. Mm-hmm. And he was so hardcore. He was so competitive. He worked his butt off. He got up to about 80 employees and was the biggest kind of shop for that kind of business in town, and crushed it. And he retired about 5 years ago at the age of 55.
Mm. How did that money story that changed over time impact your own money story? Because, you know, it's funny because I have a very similar story. I mean, my dad's not an entrepreneur. I mean, he's not, you know, ultra wealthy, but I would say he's upper middle class. He's a college professor who's tenured. So I got to see him go from being a PhD student, and I got to wear Pro Wings. If I don't know if you remember those. They were made at a shoe store called Payless Shoe Stores.
Yeah, of course.
And, you know, I got Pro Wings in seventh grade. My sister got $100 designer jeans because by the time my dad was a tenured professor, she was in junior high. So I'm curious, like, how did your money story evolve?
Funny. You know what? I mean, what I find is so interesting, what's really, you know, if I look down right now, I'm looking at my wrist, and my wrist has two things on it. One is a tattoo of the number 333, which is a really kind of auspicious and prominent number in my life. The other thing is a rubber band. And the rubber band I just put on today, and the reason that it's on there is I'm kind of reprogramming my brain around money. And what I mean by that is when I was, you know, when I was, let's say, 24, I went from making $50,000 a year to making $500,000 a year in less than 12 months. Mm-hmm. And that was a transition from being a firefighter to being in real estate. And just, you know, not everyone makes 500 grand a year. I worked my balls off and made 500 grand in that year. And that was because of like continuously programming my brain around money. I was just devouring books. I would every morning, the first words out of my mouth were this like affirmation statement that I had, it stating exactly how much money I wanted to make, when I wanted to make it by, what I was going to do in return for that money, you know, what I would give to charity, that kind of thing. And I would read that every morning, and it was the last words out of my mouth before bed. And I read that statement. This is a Think and Grow Rich thing. I don't know if you've read any Napoleon Hill stuff, of course. So, you know, I read that thing religiously every morning and every night for a year, and it worked. I programmed my brain like crazy, and I ended up making 500 grand because of it. So then like fast forward to after becoming a millionaire in my mid-20s and doing really well in real estate, I went into the philanthropic side of things, built a company called Change Heroes, poured all my money from the real estate company, any properties that I owned, I sold them. I sold like everything I owned, poured it into a startup called Change Heroes, which was in essence raising money to build schools and libraries and water projects in developing countries all over the world. And I'll skip the whole, you know, maybe we'll get into it later, but like the impact that it made, and just say as a business, it didn't work. As a business, it went under. And as a business, I actually had to go bankrupt because of it. Mm-hmm. Because I was like hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt because I'd poured all this money into it, taken up personal loans, taken loans from friends, poured it all into it, thinking that I'd be able to make it work. Didn't work. I went down, became bankrupt. And now you and I are talking, I'm two months away from being out of personal bankruptcy and using this time to just like the equivalent of like a prisoner being in jail who's just like learning languages and learning law, and they're going to come out just like guns ablaze. No, that's a bad analogy. Guns ablazing from coming out of jail, but you know what I mean? Coming out there and like becoming a lawyer or whatever it is. And so that's what I'm doing. I'm getting ready to come out of bankruptcy and with a reprogrammed mind back to a wealth mindset rather than a poverty mindset, which is what I was in for a while and kind of hit the ground running. So long story short, how my parents impacted me with money was one, my dad showed me that hard work, like persistence pays off. And my parents, I think, I don't know that they always looked at me as being, let's say, bright. And so therefore, I didn't look at myself as being that bright. I just looked at myself as being someone who would outwork the other people, if that makes sense. Like I saw my dad outwork everyone. And so I knew that if I just outworked people, then I would, you know, do as good as I could possibly do. So that's probably the main thing that I picked up from them that correlates to money is that persistence pays off.
Yeah. So two questions come from that. One, you know, I think a lot of us know this idea of the sort of Napoleon Hill reprogramming your brain to have sort of this abundance mindset, mm-hmm. knowing the certain mm-hmm. day. Why do you think that people don't achieve that despite knowing what they do about all this stuff around personal development? And two, I mean, going from, you know, one extreme to the other, how did you handle that? Like, how did you not let that become, you know, incredibly paralyzing?
To answer the first part of the question, the answer in simple is because we or they or me at times are lazy, period. They're fucking lazy. They know that this stuff is readily available. Every single book on self-development and making money, they're all saying the same thing.
Yeah.
And a lot of them, they're many, many, many of them, the vast majority in my experience are written by people that know what they're talking about. Yet we read them, and because of laziness, because of being against change, we pass it off as, well, I don't know if I trust that. Or we look for excuses to why that book isn't applicable to our lives. when in reality, the core, like the seed, the nucleus, is being lazy. And you could say lazy is being like a synonym for not wanting change. Mm-hmm. You know, like the way that our egos, in my experience, the way that our egos work is that they don't like change. They want to know what's going to happen. They want as much certainty as humanly possible, and change does not bring certainty. So the ego is not going to want change because it doesn't give it the thing that it wants most, which is like security and certainty, which are both completely abstract concepts, if you ask me. But and so that way it paralyzes us. We get this like analysis paralysis, and we just look for all the excuses why not to do it. And in reality, you know, like if you're wanting to learn how to walk, you just watch people that walk, and eventually try it a bunch of times, and before you know it, you can walk. If you're trying to make money, you just read what people do to make money and do what they do. And that's why I just wanted to break kind of money down into being as simple as possible, and just like trusting the people that wrote these books that they were right, and just, you know, diving full in, like trusting so full on that I would wake up every morning and go to bed every night, you know, reading these silly words out loud, but like into the mirror in the bathroom or wherever it was, and just trusting that it would actually work. And again, it's not just trust, it's kind of getting over this laziness and being, I'm kind of rambling right now, but also kind of thinking what will happen if I don't do this. Mm-hmm. You know, chances are you'll be in the same position. Like there's some really good Tony Robbins stuff where he future paces people, and he talks about how, you know, what would your life be like in 5 years if you don't change anything? What would your life be like in 10 years if you don't change anything? What will it be like in 20 years? And you start picturing yourself at like 40 and 45 and 50 and 60, not having changed everything, still scraping by, still wanting to shop at Whole Foods, but shopping at somewhere else instead because you want to save money, and kind of staying in this like weird, uncomfortable yet subconsciously comfortable bubble, and living a life that is less than what you know you're capable of, and ideally less than you know that you deserve. Mm-hmm. So long story short, behind all of this is like, if the why is big enough, is like, I don't want to live like that in a few years. I don't want to, you know, not be able to put my kids in the sports that they want to play. And I don't want to not be able to take care of my parents when they get sick. And I don't want to not be able to pay my medical bills if something happens. Like building up that why strong enough to like force you out of being adverse to change and force you out of that laziness. And then the next step is like finding someone that you're going to follow, whether it be a book or a mentor, and trusting what they say and following it every day.
Yeah. What about the second part of it?
I don't even remember what that was.
Going from one extreme to the other, going from being, you know, ultra wealthy to suddenly finding yourself in bankruptcy. Like, how did you not let that become paralyzing?
You know, the main extreme was going from being totally broken in debt to being a millionaire. That was the biggest, most of the stark contrast. Mm-hmm. And it was a wonderful contrast, and it was great. And I felt great about it. And I stayed at that income level for about 4 or 5 years. Me going from very financially stable and very financially sound and confident to going bankrupt, that took longer. Mm-hmm. You know, that took a while. That took a lot of, you know, we raised capital for the company that I was building. There was a lot of opportunities for us to get out of that hole. I look back and I know that if I was the CEO now, back then, I think either we would have figured it out, or we would have made it through. And who knows, maybe that company would be worth a lot of money and getting acquired or something like that, and stuff would be different. But I learned a lot in that process. And so in that, like, let's say slow spirally death downward toward bankruptcy, there were like an exponential amount of learnings, and more learnings than I would ever have learned if everything just succeeded. So I look back at it, I'm like profoundly thankful for all the lessons that I learned. It still hurts to think about sometimes, but you know, that contrast, like to answer your question clearly, is that contrast was like stark, going from nothing to having a lot, and going from a lot to having nothing was almost like your hair growing. It happened so slow. It happened so slow. And then I woke up, I was like, wait a second, I'm in a hole and I don't think I'm going to be able to get out of this. Uh-huh. You know, like there's no way with the interest payments that I'm going to have to do. And once the company finally collapsed, that was my one vehicle to kind of bring myself out of it. And once that vehicle, you know, stalled or lost its engine or whatever you want to use as an analogy, that's when I realized, like, holy shit, I have to go bankrupt. Mm-hmm. And which was like a huge kick in the, whatever you want to call it, the egoic nuts for me. Yeah. A very humbling experience, yet something I already look at as being one of the best things that ever happened to me.
Did you go through like periods of depression or anxiety through all of this? And how did you navigate that, sort of the mental health aspects of all of this? Because I can't imagine that's not mentally just incredibly taxing.
Oh, it's man, it's like, it's not having money that was the worst part. The worst part was getting on the phone and calling all of my investors and saying, hey, I lost your money. You know, you invested in me and you trusted in me and I lost it. So sure, 9 out of 10 startups fail. I get that. And a lot of people say that, don't worry, 9 out of 10 fail. I was like, I didn't plan on being the 9 out of 10. Mm-hmm. You know, my investors were betting on me being the 1 out of 10. And calling them all up and feeling, I just felt so much, I felt like I disappointed people. I felt ashamed that I'd failed. I felt like I disappointed people. I felt like I'd let them down. And that was the hardest part for me, because I have always been really sensitive to what other people think. I've always cared far too much what other people think. So you can imagine being a people pleaser, being a, you know, success addict, someone who's always been done well, and then not just failing, but I'm talking like skidding on my face failing, you know, and then having to call everyone up and be like, by the way, I just failed. And because I failed, you're losing your 25 grand or you're losing your 250 grand or whatever it is that you put in. Those calls were just so, you know, devastating. And what was incredible about it is that some of them, the guy who, you know, put in $250,000, actually a guy who put in 350 grand, he put in more than anyone else. He was like, just get up, dust yourself off, move on to the next thing. You know, you gave it your all, good job. You made an impact in the world. And, you know, I believe in you for your next venture, you know, which was incredible. And then you go to the people that put in, a couple people that put in 10 grand were just all over me like white on rice and making me feel 10 times, let's say what their actions made me feel 10 times worse than I had already felt.
Yeah.
It's such a trip. Like the, and that seemed to be a kind of a common theme. The experienced investors were like, look, dude, you tried. Good try. Get up, dust yourself off and move on. The smaller investors wanted to try to find every excuse in the world to make it even harder than it needed to be.
Today's episode of The Unmistakable Creative is sponsored by DesignCrowd. Unmistakable Creative listeners have used DesignCrowd for logo, web, and graphic design. Here's how it works. You go to designcrowd.com and you set up your design brief, and you'll get submissions from anywhere between 60 to 100 designers from around the world. If you like the designs you get, you can then approve payment. If you don't like what you get, you can go back to the crowd and ask for more, or ask for your money back. To see what other Unmistakable Creative listeners have designed and save $100 on your first project, visit designcrowd.com/creative and use the promo code creative at checkout for $100 off. Today's episode is also sponsored by our friends at HostGator. They host your website and they have 24/7 live support via phone, chat, and email. An easy-to-use website builder if you're not tech-savvy, one-click WordPress installs, and if you want to switch from an existing host to HostGator, it's free and it's simple. And because you're an Unmistakable Creative listener, you're getting 30% off all of their hosting packages. So visit HostGator.com/creative and use the promo code creative at checkout for 30% off. So during this period of you know, implementing the Think and Grow Rich and going from, you know, where you were to 500,000 in the first year, did your day-to-day actions also change in terms of, you know, basically shifting from a poverty consciousness to more of an abundance
one? Oh, yeah.
What like daily actions changed in terms of just general things? Is the reason I brought this up is, you know, because I remember Seth Godin said very distinctly in one of his programs called Leap First, he said, you can't be a person who tips $20 on a $6 cup of coffee and still have the same money story. He said, you know, what he said is become a philanthropist every single time you get asked to make a donation, make one. And he said, the thing is that behavior starts to unwind the story. So I'm very curious what your day-to-day actions were like during that period.
Yeah, that's, you know, that's I don't know, it's really good timing that we're talking about this because literally, again, yesterday I was talking about one of my co-founders about this exact topic. And if I was going to take you, why don't we like kind of compare and contrast?
Yeah,
a day in the life before,
sure,
and a day in the life poor and a day in the life wealthy.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing that probably offends some people, but that's what it is. A day in the life poor. Wake up at, you know, maybe 8 o'clock, maybe 7:30. Get up, maybe go to the gym, do my thing, go to work, come home kind of tired. Maybe I don't know, have a nap or whatever, do play, hang out with friends, go to bed, get up, repeat. And if someone asks me for money, being like, no, I don't have enough. A day in the life wealthy. And what I mean by wealthy, let's say mindset wealthy, because these are habits that I introduced before actually making, you know, a couple million bucks in my 20s. These are the habits that led to making that money. Okay, so with that mind switch, when I actually like started taking in all this content from really wealthy, you know, whether it be authors or documentaries or autobiographies that I read or whatever it is, the concepts are the same. Number one, give away at least, you know, 5 to 10% of your net income, before you have the money to give away, in essence. So like if you make $2,200 a month, which is what I was making at the time as a firefighter, then you give away, then I was giving away $2,200 is what I was taking home net. So I would give away $220 every month, 10% of my net income. So you do that. And the way that that makes, anyways, we'll get into that in a second, but that's number one. Number two is what I kept reading is that these authors would say, I've never met a successful person that doesn't get up early. And I'm talking about like early, like 5 a.m. early. So I started getting up at 5 a.m.
Yeah.
And I couldn't stay awake because it was so freaking early. So I would get up. I'd force myself to drive to Starbucks. I'd sit down. I'd have a mocha. I don't know why I drank mochas back in the day, but, you know, mocha with whipped cream. And I'd sit there with the mocha and I would read. I'd read for an hour. Because that's another one of those kind of success principles that you hear over and over and over again, yet barely any of us follow, is that successful people read. I think the average CEO reads about 60 books a year, is what I recently read. So they're reading at least a book a week, right? So a little bit more than a book a week. So I would read for an hour and just like continue to what I had read about is like sharpening the saw, like really investing in yourself, you know? And so I would read and then I'd go home and I'd plan the whole day out. So that's number one, giving 5 to 10%. Number two, getting up way earlier than you think is comfortable. And number three, completing my day on paper before I ever began it in person. Mm-hmm. And that to me, like at the moment, is something I'm finally back to that has the most profound effect on my day. Is I go through the whole day. Here's the things that I want to accomplish. Here's all the calls that I want to make. Here's all the emails I want to send. Then I make, you know, very hardcore OCD lists because I love lists more than anything. And before I start my day, I know exactly what I want to accomplish. And then I go through, start the day. And then I don't have that like, someone says, hey, do you have time at 2:00 to meet up for a quick coffee? My answer is always no, because I've already planned out the whole day. Mm-hmm. And I know what I'm doing. You know, unless that coffee is going to correspond to one of my goals, then the answer is no. And so those three things, I think, probably contributed the most towards the going from, like I said, like 50 grand to making 500 grand. And it was all, you know, like you can hear, it's like all discipline. And then one thing that would kind of sprinkle in on top was meditation, just making sure that I was meditating every day.
Funny, you said you pretty much have described my average day.
Oh, good. You're crushing it.
Yeah, which is good to know. Yeah, I mean, I read every morning for at least, I think, like anywhere between 25 to 50 pages every morning, meditate.
What do you read that early? Like, are you doing spiritual stuff or?
No, I mean, it varies. I mean, sometimes it's nonfiction. Sometimes I will return to books that I've already read before. The reason I read every morning is because I usually write 1,000 words every morning as well.
Wow.
And to do the 1,000 words, I need to read something in order to have material to just sort of, you know, kind of prime my brain. So it'll range for anywhere, you know, sometimes I'll dive back into a sort of spiritual book. Other times, you know, I'll just be reading, like right now I'm reading a book called The Plant Paradox.
Cool.
And yeah, so it ranges. I mean, but I go through about 2 books a week. So
amazing. Yeah. And so for me, it's like for audiobooks, you know, those, the app, Apple AirPod, headphones, those ones that don't have a cord.
Yep.
Those have been like the biggest game changer for me because I'm flying all the time. Like this morning I was up at 4 a.m., which is equivalent to 3 a.m. over here, and then I had 2 flights. But all of that time is just like knowledge time. You know, I probably put in, I guess it's about a quarter of a book within that time on Audible and using that. And just like, and the thing is, it just keeps continuously putting your mind in the right mindset, you know? And that's what it's all about. It's not about like, it's like, you know, this, I think this is another Tony Robbins thing. The guy's just a genius. He talks about, you know, if you're really overweight, you don't need to go out there and like find the fanciest diet and the best like kinesthetic like workout and the best trainer in the world. He's like, get on a fucking treadmill and run every single day, right? You don't need, if you're way out, away far from where you want to be, just get up and do the basic thing that you will actually do. And so I think it's the same with books. Mm-hmm. It's not a matter of finding the best book possible. It's continuously putting stuff in your brain that's going to make you smarter and it's going to keep you in the mindset that you want to be in, because it's so easy nowadays. I mean, turn on the news or start, you know, trolling Trump websites or whatever it is. All you read is horrendous stuff that's happening in the world.
Yeah.
And if you read that, that's all that's going into your brain. Then you start feeling completely pessimistic when in reality, if we actually look like the facts that are, as far as we go, is like poverty alleviation, diseases, you know, infant mortality, like we're way better than we've ever been in our, you know, history of human species. Yet we think things are worse than they've ever been before, because that's all we're developing. empowering. And so, you know, it's up to us. And it's people, I kind of get some pushback on this. Sometimes people are like, well, you should really know what's going on in the world. And I totally agree to a point. Mm-hmm. But I also agree that it's completely up to you to control your energy. It's up to you to control your vibe, let's say. Yeah. And you need to be putting in as much, if not drastically more, let's say, good stuff, like really focusing on the good of what's happening in the world, as you do the quote unquote real stuff that you know watch on CNN.
Yeah, it's funny because our content strategist King Shook said, he's like, does any of this stuff affect you personally day to day? He's like, if not, then it's not as relevant as you think it is.
Yeah, exactly.
Good one. One of the other things that struck me that I want to actually spend some time talking about is the fact that you worked as a firefighter, which you brought up multiple times. And I'm curious. I mean, I can't imagine that being a firefighter didn't come with, you know, incredible life lessons, leadership lessons, business lessons. I'm curious, like, what did you learn from being a firefighter that you've applied in your life going forward?
I think the one thing that stands out, which has been really good and has been really bad in my life, and I'll give you a reason why, is this: if someone's not dying, that I'm not worried. You know what I mean? Like if someone says like, "Oh my God, my best friend just, you know, fell out of a tree from 30 feet and broke their ribs, and now they're in the hospital," I go, "Okay, good. They're not dead. Next." You know what I mean? Like I don't really, stuff doesn't really affect me unless there's something like very dire happening. And so that's really good in the way that I can kind of keep my head in an emergency situation. Like we did a trip to Costa Rica a while ago. I have a travel company and did a trip to Costa Rica where they built 10 homes in 2 days at an incredible time. And they were staying at this surf resort on the coast, and a bunch of people started to get sick. Because you know this restaurant had some bad stuff in the food, and so a bunch of people started to get sick, and we had to mobilize like a mobile hospital, like well equipped ambulance. We had to get doctors involved, so I was kind of like mission control from Venice, California, and because I had the experience of firefighting, I could kind of keep my head and just sort everything out when most other people were kind of freaking out, and so that's good in that case, but it's bad in the case of like actually feeling, I would say, deep empathy for situations that aren't life and death. Mm-hmm. And I've found it tough in the past to honor that some situations are more stressful to some people than they might be to myself. Mm-hmm. And to actually be there for them. And that's where it sucked. That's where I've really fallen down. And I found myself apologizing a lot. It's like, because I haven't been able to empathize with them enough to like really be present for them and be like, yeah, I can see this is a really tough time for you. And it's, you know, whatever someone's feeling is completely valid. And I found in the past that I've discounted what they're feeling just because I wouldn't think it's as big a deal. Yet that doesn't matter. Like what matters is how they feel about it. So it's kind of hurt me in relationships at times, and has actually really served me in business at times.
Mm, wow. Well, let's do this. I want to talk now about the work that you're doing with travel, because that's actually how I was introduced to you, and that's how Rima connected with you. So what prompted the founding of the current company that you're working on? Like, you know, how did it come about? What was the seed that led to the idea?
Oh, man. You know what? This kind of goes back to the beginning of the interview, which is, here's something I forgot to mention, is that, you know, we're talking about like giving, giving that 10% of your net income, or 5 or 10%, whatever it is that feels right to you. That for me came from wanting to make more money, which is kind of interesting. It's like, wait a sec. So you became this philanthropist because you wanted to make more money? And the answer to that is like, kind of, because back when I was in firefighting, I decided I wanted to make more money. I wanted to be a millionaire at some point and feel, you know, financially free. And I started out reading all these books, and they all said that you have to tithe, you have to give 5 or 10% of your income. And so I did that because I wanted to make more money, which is kind of a funny place to come from, you know? And I hear a lot of people are like, wow, you're doing such great work in the world. You must care so much. And I do now, but back then it was actually about making money, which is kind of funny. And so I started giving back then, realized very quickly how amazing it felt to help people and how incredible it feels to help people via the energy of money. So back in firefighting, when I was giving that $220 away each month, that's the best I felt all month. You know, I would give it to an eating disorder clinic because some people in my family that have suffered from eating disorders, or I'd give it to a women's shelter, or I'd give it to, you know, whatever the charity is of choice was that month. And when I gave that money, I felt incredibly abundant. I felt so grateful. I felt humble. I felt just so in flow. It felt like the most natural thing that I could do is like you just give, you know. And I knew that it was only 10%, so it was like the amount that I felt like I was supposed to put aside. So that became my favorite thing each month. That led to wanting to do a bit more. So I went on this trip to Kenya and Uganda, had this like really incredible travel or transformational experience where I decided that I wanted to do even more. So I got back and started still giving away 10% of my money, but started building a company that was involved around philanthropy. And then that led into starting Change Heroes, which is around people raising money to build schools and libraries. And then after all of those, we had about 15,000 people from 80 countries around the world give $3.33 a day for 3 months. I know it's a lot of numbers, but we had all these people give, and they all started asking, can I go see the school? Can I go see the house? And I remember thinking, man, I would love for that to happen, because then they could have the same experience that I had. You know, they could have that like transformational moment and maybe change the trajectory of their lives. And so we did the first trip in December 2015 as like a test, as a pilot, like to see if this thing would work. And it went like incredibly well. We built like 20 houses in 2 days. They're all prefabricated, and we partnered with a nonprofit on the ground. We did it in El Salvador. The people had an amazing time. It was transformational. It was like transformation to like to the cellular level in these people. And I was like, wow, wouldn't it be amazing if we could replicate this, if we could do this, like I'm talking like weekly or monthly, and just continuously pump out more altruistic, philanthropic, empathetic human beings via them going through an incredible travel experience, you know, like a puppy mill for good people, let's say. Mm-hmm. And that was the idea. And we just went with it. We started, and at the time Change Heroes was, you know, like I said, it was kind of going down, and, you know, but this seed of Journey was kind of percolating. And, We've since then, we've done 17 trips. We've brought almost 500 people to 6 countries. We've built 125 houses. We've refurbished 3 schools. We've built a skate park from scratch for at-risk youth in Costa Rica. And after those impact days, we always do like 2 deep days of like impact, whether it be building or refurbishing kind of thing. Then we do 3 days of like of spiritual or adventure, let's say. You know, we go to the mountains in Mexico. We're doing this trip in August where we're refurbishing a school for 2 days, and then we're gonna go to the mountains to this incredible place called the Hotel of the Light, where we do Mayan sweat lodges, we do yoga, we do sound meditation, we do like little sharing circles for people to talk about like how it made them feel to meet these kids that were living in the work, or you know, going to this school, and what we knew that their life trajectory was like. And we have a blast doing it, go to hikes to these pyramids and stuff like that. So from that was the seed, was like, is it possible to create an experience that genuinely transforms people at scale? Is it possible to scale empathy, in essence, you know, to scale something that, you know, it's kind of hit or miss in our world? And so far, all indications point to, yes, it is possible. And I hope that's, you know, that's exactly what we're doing.
Just a quick reminder for those of you who are interested or didn't hear the ad at the beginning of the episode. In the next few weeks, we're looking to redesign the Unmistakable Creative website, and we know there are a lot of you in our community who are designers and developers. If you're a WordPress developer or designer, we'd love to hear from you. Visit unmistakablecreative.com/redesign to see the website specs and tell us a bit more about your work and your portfolio.
So I'm curious, you know, you've alluded to transformation a lot in the lives of the people that come. I mean, I think the transformation that occurs for the people that you provide, you know, this philanthropic effort for is very clear. I'm curious, what have been the changes that you've seen in the lives of the people that have gone on these trips, both internally and externally?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, they hit everyone so different. You know, like we were on a trip to Colombia a couple of weeks ago, maybe a month ago now, and so we brought 60 people down, and we built, I think we built 10 homes in 2 days. And then we went to this little island off the coast of Cartagena for a few days, and it hit everyone totally different. We had some people on the bill that said, you know, how you doing? And they're like, terrible. You know, this little boy just keeps asking for clean water. And this little, you know, this little girl lives in this house that doesn't even have a floor. She lives on the dirt, and it's made of 2x4s and tarps. And so some people, it hits them, they see it, they can't reconcile, at least in the short term, how they just flew from a place that you can just walk into Whole Foods and get any kind of food and clean water you want to a place that the people just can't even find clean drinking water. right? It's incomprehensible to some people. Other people, you go up to and say, hey, how's the build going? They're like, it's amazing. I met this amazing family. They're so resilient. They're so powerful. They're so dignified, and they're et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so right now, we only get to see people like on the trip and like the events that we hold afterwards. We do like little speaking nights and salons and, you know, fundraisers and stuff like that. And we ask people how they're integrating. But I'd say overall, the typical journey of someone is they go on this trip. On the trip, they hold it together. When they come home, they have a bit of reverse culture shock of like, oh my God, I was just in this place where people don't even have homes or clean water. And they have this reverse culture shock, and depending on who they are and if they've been traveling before, they go through a period of reintegration, which might take, you know, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks of kind of getting used to their surroundings. And then ideally at that point, they transition into, well, what can I do to make a change? Mm-hmm. You know, and we've seen people quit their jobs and like travel across the country because it hit them at a core where they wanted to start raising money for charity and they wanted to live their lives differently because of the experience that they had. We've had people just become big philanthropists. We've had like big donors. We've had people come on 3 trips within a year because it's like something that's resonating so deeply to them that once they finish a trip within a month, they've booked another trip with us. And we've had people that have come on a trip. You know, we had a woman come on the first trip. She started planning her own trips with us after that and brought like, I think 25 people. You know, it just kind of, it depends on what they feel like their contribution to the world should be. You know, we love it when people do that. Like we had this guy, BC Cerna, who's like an Instagram storyteller and influencer. Mm-hmm. He came on a trip with us, brought a mentee of his, and the next trip that he came on, he brought 12 of his followers from Instagram. The next trip he came on, he brought 40. And so that's what we want to do, is be this like vehicle for social change for people. So they don't have to rack their brains too hard about how they can impact the world. They can impact it by passing that transformational experience on to other people. Mm-hmm.
For you personally, how has your definition of success changed as a byproduct of, you know, sort of the journey that you've been on?
You know what? I feel like I'm like peaking. Not peaking as in I'm just about to go downhill, but I feel like I've reached a new level of success right now, yeah. Which is funny because if I open up, let's do this like real time here. I'm going to open up my Chase app and tell you how much money is in my bank account. Because if I say I feel like the most successful I've ever felt, which I do right now, I feel by far the most successful I've ever felt, hands down. And my checking account is $72.21. There's $400 saved up to invest because I was put aside a little bit of money to invest, but it's $405 right now. I drained that account. I've got $255 to give away in my charity account that's been kind of saved up. And then I got, well, you know, $30 here and there, and I got $1,200 for taxes. So that, you know, that's probably not the bank account that you'd usually hear from someone who thinks it feels like they're the most successful they've ever been, especially having been a millionaire for a number of years of my life. But this is like, I'm doing it every day. I wake up so enthused. I wake up so vibrant and like on fire for what we're doing in the world and what we're creating. And the reason that I feel more successful now than I've ever felt is because I'm also doing stuff for myself. I'm not just building a social good company and pouring all of my heart and soul and sweat and blood and tears into it and ruining myself financially in the process. I'm doing stuff for myself. I'm making sure that I'm bringing in a decent salary from Journey, and I'm doing stuff on the side where I'm helping people spread their messages through speaking, and I'm making money through that. I'm like actually concentrating as much on myself, at least as much on myself as I am on giving back to the world. And so they're an equal contribution mode right now, whereas like real estate was all about me, right? Mm-hmm. I was the millionaire. I was the one who's living on the ocean and had the bike and the motorbike and the truck and all the rental properties and stuff like that. Then flip flop to Change Heroes. Change Heroes ended up impacting 200,000 people all over the world. We built 400 schools, libraries, water projects, anti-sex trafficking work, girl scholarships, you know, veterans rehabilitation, homelessness initiatives. We did 400 projects all over the world that impacted 200,000 people over the lifespan of those projects. Yet I was doing nothing for myself. I was burnt out. I was stressed. I was full of anxiety. I could barely keep up with the workload. I couldn't keep up with the workload. I had a company that was failing. And so it was all about impact. And now the reason I feel like more successful than anything else, and those are finally equal. I've realized that I can't just give all the time because I'll burn myself out and then the things won't work. And I can't just take all the time because, I mean, well, I guess I got over that in my early 20s, learning that you can't just take and it's not the most fulfilling life. So right now I just feel incredibly grateful, humble, genuinely, obsessively happy because every day I wake up enthused for what I'm doing. And that's what it's all about, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's not about like the destination. If you really believe in the quote, it's about the journey, not the destination, then I truly feel like I feel like I'm the epitome of that quote. I'm enjoying this journey so fucking much. It's crazy. And like, even right now, I'm just sitting at my buddy Mark Shapiro's place. He has a podcast himself called Are You Being Real? He's amazing. And he says, look at your life, dude. I was like, what do you mean? And he's like, so you're just going to hop on a podcast and tell people what you're passionate about? That's what you're doing this afternoon? I'm like, yeah, I guess you're right. Like, how incredible is this? You know what I mean? Like, so that, I guess at the end of the day, that's what I feel the most successful is, because my day to day, I just love it. I absolutely love the team I'm working with. I love the place that I live. So even though I have $72.21 in my checking account right now, yeah, that is but a small fragment of you know, the contribution to my overall happiness. Yeah.
Wow. Well, there's no way we can get out of this conversation without talking about surfing.
Yes, finally. Waiting for this.
I'm curious, what is the role that surfing has played in your life?
I mean, it just brings me back, you know, like I fell in love with surfing when I was 18. I was in Australia. I was traveling for about 7 months and I just fell in love with surfing. I love the culture. I love the chill. It feels to me like you're like one with nature. You know what I mean? It's like you're literally inside nature, in the water, and you're riding this energy. For me, it's just like, I love snowboarding. I love action sports. I love a lot of things, but to me, nothing compares to feeling the energy that a wave has, because that wave started way the frick out in the middle of the ocean, and it's taken however long it's taken to get to you. And it has an energy. It's had an energy for I should probably Google that. How long do waves exist for? You know what I mean? Or how far away do they come from? But it's had an energy for a profound length of time. And then you get to experience that energy. You're already in the water and it picks you up and you like feel that energy. You feel like, I don't know, there's no other feeling in the world that I've ever felt like it. And then you ride it. And it's like this, also like the juicy, like masculine obsession with coming close to death, but not dying. Right. You know, I don't know. Yeah. We don't even have to go super into like the masculine and feminine on this podcast, but you know, it's just fact that men, we like to get close to death. The more masculine your essence, the closer to death that you like to get without dying. And I love surfing because it gives me that feeling of like, oh shit, like I better catch this thing right or I'm going to get tough. You know, especially like the big waves. If you go down, the chances of death are there. Yeah. You know what I mean? And it probably sounds so stupid to a lot of people that have maybe a different kind of core essence. But when you have, I don't know, the feeling that I have inside, like I've run with the bulls and I've skydived a whole bunch of times and bungee jumped and done all the stuff. There's nothing like that exhilaration of like, holy cow, I could have died right there. You know, but I didn't. And yeah, Let's go get an acai bowl. So surfing for me fulfills a ton of stuff. My oneness with nature, it's meditative for me. It feels so connected and refreshed. Salt water is incredibly healing in and of itself, let alone being in it for like a beautiful like hour or two. Uh-huh. You get to go out there and watch the sunset with unimpeded sunsets. Like there's nothing between you and the sun basically, except for water, not even sand. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And sunrises. I don't know. I could speak about surfing forever, but it's a... You know, why don't you tell me, Serena, what do you think? What's surfing mean to you?
I think you've described it fairly accurately. No, I mean, to me, I always say, yeah, it's like having a church, a gym, and a bar all in one activity. It means your social, physical, and spiritual needs.
Yeah, totally. You're not wasted, which is good.
Yeah, definitely.
From the bar. Yeah, man. What about you? You take us deep here. Give us some profound wisdom that you've read about lately in your plant book or something that's been like on your mind. That if I was interviewing you on a podcast, you'd be like, this is the thing that your audience needs to hear.
All right. So I'll share a little bit about what I've been working on, because I've been working around a lot of stuff around productivity and creativity. I think that largely we don't have time management issues. We have attention management issues. And I think all our time management issues stem from our attention management issues. In fact, we would need far less time to get all the things we needed to do done if we were better at managing our attention.
Oh, wow. Great.
Yeah.
And how do you overcome that? What tell well, us like what
you brought up?
What's a typical day for you? What's the ideal day?
the ideal day for me involves waking up and going straight to the beach and being in the water for 4 hours. Today is far from the ideal day. I had three back-to-back interviews, which never happens. But yeah, that's, you know, but I also know, I was like, okay, if I do three back-to-back interviews today, it means I get all day tomorrow. I think largely attention is about really kind of, one, being learning to be present, you know, when you're doing something like having a conversation with somebody like this one, making sure that, you know, your phone is off, that you don't have a thousand other things open. I think that, strangely, like, being present is something that we're losing, and learning to be present is something that we're more and more losing, to the point of being a serious concern. Like, and, you know, there have been numerous studies that show this stuff, you know, causes mental health issues related to our anxiety issues. But more than that, like, if you want to be the type of person that you were talking about at the very beginning, who has the habits of, you know, wealthy people, you've got to learn to manage your attention.
Totally.
Yeah. So that's what I would say.
I dig it, man. It's like full attention. What do you think for, like, energy flow? So, like, for myself, I don't schedule anything at 3 p.m.
Yeah,
I don't. My energy is, like,
I don't do anything from 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. That's, like, my prime time.
What?
Yeah. No, nobody gets my time from 6 a.m. to 10 a.m.
Oh, good. Yes. I thought you meant, like, you don't do anything. Like, that's my prime time, too. Yeah. Morning. Stuff, you crush it. Get everything done. And don't you find, like, if you get to, like, 10 a.m., you haven't done all your stuff, or someone screwed around with you in the morning, something like that, you're, like, your whole day, you're just like,
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Yeah. Well, this has been awesome. So I want to finish with one last question, which is how we finish all of our interviews with the Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
Ooh. In my mind, it's someone who is fully them, who's fully themselves. Not that they've defined themselves, but that they're literally living, this is from your talk on presence, they're living in the present moment, unimpeded by worrying about what other people think, caring too much about what's going to happen in the future, positioning, posturing, all of the stuff that means the same thing, but is a different word. It's people that are living out their personal legend. There's no better compliment than that I've ever had than someone saying, Taylor, you're just so you. And I said, I remember that happening. I said, what do you mean? And they're like, you're just so you. You're just so, like, you know, you're just you. You're very unique. And I was like, wow, thank you. It was like the equivalent of someone saying, you know, you're the most beautiful person ever, whatever it is. That's all I want to do, is I want to be me. And I want to live out every day feeling like me. And every interaction where I'm just, like, staring into someone's eyes because I'm not caring about how they're looking at me. And I'm just, like, seeing them because I'm letting them see me.
Wow. Well, I think that makes a very fitting end to our conversation. Where can people learn more about your work?
Oh, I hate that. Well, if you want to come on a trip, come with me to Mexico, August 3rd. Is this going to be up before August 3rd, Srini?
It's possible, given that it's July 18th.
Okay. It's WeJourney.co. WeJourney.co is our site. That's where all the trips are. We're doing Colombia, Mexico, Nicaragua, building a bunch of homes, which is wonderful. And the other thing is, I mean, you know, speaking stuff is on TaylorConroy.com. Or, you know, shoot me an email. It's not too hard to figure out. It's Taylor@WeJourney.co. If I can ever help collaborate or create some game-changing idea that will do wonderful things in the world while producing revenue, that is my obsession. So I'm happy to connect with people on that all day long.
Awesome. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member, who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.